All right. I am actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ Diala Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, musicologist, luxury, a.k.a. the guy who sometimes talks about interpolation on the internet. That's me.
Sometimes you whisper it.
Sometimes I even whisper it.
This is one song, and before we get into it, luxury, we are not alone today.
It's true.
We are special joined guest. Today by a live studio audience. One Song Nation, make some noise.
Woo! Wow, that is so cool. That is really cool. I'm going to get addicted to that. Can we have you guys come back every time? Seriously, yeah. This is great.
The endorphins I am feeling right now.
A rush.
Now, usually we choose a song that's the opposite of a deep cut. If you look back at our previous episodes, we've done Rihanna's Umbrella, Doja Cat's Paint the Town Red, Britney's Toxic, Outkast's Mrs. Jackson, like, you know, huge songs.
That's right.
Huge, huge songs.
But today we're going to shine a light on a very different song, a bit of a hidden gem, if you will. And you're going to come away from this episode with a new appreciation for what might be considered a bit of a deeper cut.
It's very true. But listen, if a bona fide hip-hop legend calls you, a man who's won, you know, he's gone platinum, he's won Grammys, he's won an Oscar. If a guy like that calls you up and says, Diallo, I want to talk about one song, and that one song is Cole Lampin' with Flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You
everyone's
the phone. You're
favorite
like, who
song.
Is that? Who is that strange man? No, seriously. You best believe we're going to talk about legendary rap group Public Enemy and their song Cold Lampin' with Flavor off the classic album It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Ladies and gentlemen, that's right. It's Questlove. It's Luxury. It's me and the One Song Nation. And it's live.
Yeah.
Cold Lampin' with Flavor by Public Enemy. This is One Song.
Woo!
Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Quest, when we were texting back and forth, I think Welcome to the Terror Dome is kind of like one of our favorites.
Yes.
You know?
But Welcome to the Terror Dome. Come on,
you chose Cold Lampin' with Flavor, and I just have to ask, why that and not Welcome to the Terror Dome or Fight the Power or any number of their like more well-known hits?
Well, because I feel like the best part of performing a dissection is discovering what's inside.
Mm.
And for me, though, Public Enemy is a group, usually in hip-hop, whoever pioneers it first really doesn't get the credit or the just due. It's always the person that comes behind them.
Mm.
And really for the sound, for what Public Enemy has contributed to the culture, it kind of starts with Marley Marl, and then Public Enemy improved on that. And then Dr. Dre improved on that. So right now, like, Dr. Dre just drank everyone's milkshake. So
I want to hear why you think Marley Marl's production led to Public Enemy's production.
Okay, so here's an example. So the infamous MC Chance on the Bridge.
Of course.
Marley Marl. So
do y'all know the bridge?
We got MC Chance and Marley Marl in the house tonight.
I'm just curious. Hey, show your hands. How many of y'all know what the bridge is? That's not bad.
Well,
that's
I'll explain. Bad. All right, so this is the quickest backstory.
Okay.
Marley Marl tells the story of how he accidentally discovered sampling via the invention of the SB-12. And the SB-12 is like a very expensive machine, and only like the upper echelon sort of gets access to this thing.
It's an early sampler, right? It's an early sampler.
Right.
But less expensive than the Synclavier or whatever, these $250,000 machines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. Trevor Horn, I believe.
Definitely had a Synclavier.
Had,
oh,
yeah,
Fairlight. Sorry, Synclavier.
Fairlight. He had, well, he had all the machines.
He had all of them, right.
So as a result, his production work on Yes's Owner of a Lonely Heart
right.
is actually the first example of what? Hearing. So listen to the beginning. They take, here's the sample.
That's Yes's drummer.
So, no, this is Cool Is Back by Funk Incorporated.
Oh, that's what that is? Whoa.
Right. Oh, by the way, the very first Roots song was sampled this. That was like our first loop ever. But if you're familiar with
Baby's First Loop.
Right. Cool.
You never forget.
So the song is called Cool Is Back by Funk Incorporated, which was really big on the kind of northern funk scene. People north of London wanting to listen to raw soul music.
Oh, yeah,
instead
I've
of
heard
all.
Of northern soul. I don't know if I've heard of northern funk.
Well, northern soul is more like Motown.
Right.
Where Did Our Love Go? But then they would dig deeper. Norman Cook would go digging in America for, you know, rare 45s.
Norman Cook, of course, being
Fatboy Slim.
Fatboy Slim.
Yes. Yeah. Or even before Norman Cook, like.
Yeah, of course.
So this is the original song that Trevor Horn took for.
I remember this one. Oh, yeah. There's that. Dat, bum, bum, bum,
bum, yeah, bum, a bum. Very popular
right.
staff.
The Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Even, I think in the Synclavier, this noise is inside there.
Is.
So, yeah, for Owner of a Lonely Heart. That's the first time that we're hearing. I mean, I don't know that this is in my dad's record collection back in 1983.
Hiding. By the way, I love it when things are in the instruments that they use or the
presets,
sample,
yeah.
that we were just talking on the Rihanna episode about Umbrella. Like those drums. That,
yeah. That, you buy a Mac, you get that drum beat.
You get the drum beat.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Exactly. I believe on the for Money Cash Hoes by Jay-Z, I believe Swizz Beatz admitted that he used like. Beat number 63. Hey, Prince used, I believe, option 41, I believe, for what we know is 777-9311.
No.
Oh, the way your heart just broke right now when I broke that news to you. Like, literally, in half a second, I saw your hopes and your dreams. When
it's
Jesse,
I used option 40. That
oh
was
man, you
problem.
Were so close.
No, but literally the heartbreaking, because the thing was, I spent hours in the basement trying to do that drum pattern. You thought it was like Prince's like
yes.
master show.
No, seriously, 777-9311. The drums on that, the beat on that
are
is
insane.
Insane.
Yeah,
and by the way, you have three drummers up here
yeah.
who've all accomplished a lot as drummers. I would
an equal amount. I would say yes. Yeah.
We're all sort of like if you look up drummers, like
peers. Right. We're basically peers.
Yeah,
yeah, but this drums.
Makes no sense.
It's fun fact. Uh-uh. This is uh-uh. programmed by. Dave Garibaldi.
Tower of Power.
Of Tower of Power.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unsung hero. I mean,
yeah.
for real.
So, essentially, because Tower of Power and Earth, Wind, and Fire are managed by Robert Cavalli.
Yeah.
Like, Prince's management company.
My first boss in the record business was Robert Cavalli.
Really?
Rob Cavalli. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean,
wait,
are we
rabbit-holing too much? For everyone.
No,
that's what we came here for.
Yeah, so anyway, another fun fact I just found out. The infamous Prince clap, that noise.
Yeah.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
What?
Yeah, they just happened to be in the studio when Roger Lynn
yeah. recorded them.
Needed like them to get go in the hallway.
It's insane.
And so that's
actual hallway.
I consider that like that is to me the most essential element of a Prince song. This that clap.
For sure.
So that's Tom Petty and the Heartbreaker. So you know, it's I know that using
pre-programmed
stuff, yeah. And the shock of me finding out that a lot of Nation of Millions was aided by the pre-programmed SB-1200 drums, because in my mind I was like, wow, they did everything organically, like piecemealing like all these drums together. A mixture of the two.
We on this show we've done, you know, a lot of songs that have a sample, but also like a guitarist or a bassist in the studio, and then we've done songs like "Delight," "Groove Is in the Heart," where there's not one. There's not one musician in the
studio.
There's
not even a drum machine. It's
compiled
all coming
completely
from the samples.
Out of just sounds, yeah. And bits.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. And that Gabor reference,
right?
For that. I almost wanted to.
You saw that?
Yeah. Jump out the window when I found that. Right. So, anyway, leading back to Marley Marl. So, he started out as. There was this edit period of New York where, like, DJs that worked at record stations would try to make their own. You remember, like, master mixes?
Absolutely.
Crews like the Latin Rascals, Jelly Bean Benitez.
Well, look, Ludacris was Chris Lovella in Atlanta. And he started making his own tracks, and he stopped being Chris Lovella and became Ludacris. First thing I noticed when I saw that Mr. Magic's DJ was Marley Marl, I was like, there is a tradition of the DJ who's on at like the 4 o'clock traffic jam, like that guy putting out his own music and eventually becoming an artist in his own right. And Marley
Marl, Ludacris
was
that person.
Ludacris was Chris Lovella on 103.
That is crazy. All right, so this edit period, producers like Mantronix, the Latin Rascals, would do things like these big beat drums that sound like Art of Noise, and a whole bunch of edits that they have to do by hand. So like. This is typical, like, the Latin Rascals level of editing. This is the first Beastie Boys song before License to Ill came out. Anyway, so Marley Marl has an SB-12, and he accidentally samples a snare drum for what we now know as Honey Drippers. Impeach the President. So this snare sound.
Which I thought was just a rolling.
No, it's the first snare of Impeach the President.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have the 100 dressers in the house tonight.
And he did it by accident. He was like, wait, you mean I don't have to just, you know, by then we had all seen like the unspoken hit comedy show of the 80s starring America's former favorite dad, in which he had...
Okay, we get it, yeah.
Growing pains.
He who shall not be named.
Right.
of the pudding pops.
He shall not be given credit. But, you know, there's an episode in which Stevie Wonder is on season 2. The story is that Stevie Wonder's limousine crashes into Theo Huxtable in Denise's car, and I guess to avoid a lawsuit, he's like, come to my studio and look at my toys. Like, let me stun on you. So Stevie Wonder stunts on this family by showing him all this, like, futuristic sampling equipment, and lawsuit avoided. And, of course, we all seen this episode, and suddenly, like, we realized, like, oh, this is how music can get made. And, of course, the Casio SK-1 had just come out, and it was cheap enough for everyone to purchase. Yeah. I got it for Christmas, and then suddenly we're all doing the same thing. So
I really like the Bossa Nova set.
The cheap one. MC Lyte used that, actually, on Cabbage. Poor Georgie.
Oh, Poor Georgie. You're totally right. Yep, I can tell.
Yes, a little cheap drum machine. Anyway, so Marley Marl discovers that he can sample drums. And everything changes. So he's like, I don't have to use the stock sounds anymore. I can now just take the snare from this song, the kick from this song, and the hi-hat, and make. So what happens is, that particular song, which is called The Bridge by Marley Marl.
That is The Bridge. When I asked earlier, that is The Bridge. And I don't mean to cut you off, but the hardest part of that song is whatever that backward sample is.
There you go.
That so, goes so hard.
There's a song called Scratchin' by Magic Disco Machine. Very much used on the... So normally, like, stabs were considered... A stab is what hip-hop producers would... A stab would be a musical onomatopoeia. Mm. Like when you watch those old Batman episodes. Kablow! Blam! Right. And the whole purpose of it is to really accentuate the hardness. Like, if you're Run DMC, you want to... Like, that's a stab.
That's a stab right. by that, yeah. It's violent.
Or a jab.
But more a stab. And so... So what winds up happening is Marley samples this, but then he accidentally reverses it.
Reverse.
So now this happens. So what happens is I'll slow it down.
Wow.
Oh, he slowed it down.
That's amazing.
He'll slow it down. So that's what that sound is.
Is that a pitch down?
And so the reason why Marley Marl used that noise because his project building was right where the Queensbridge is located. And pre-Giuliani, New York, the sound of New York was traffic. Get out of my way. That sort of thing. So he's like, I wanted to create a sound that sounded like New York traffic. Mm, so thus cool. He said, this is my car horn in traffic. Wow. But we didn't know what that thing was. And so suddenly Public Enemy takes that theory, which is something that stops you in your track. Like, what the hell is that?
Something non-musical, right? Something noisy.
Right, something jarring and non-musical. And they took it to the nth degree. So, you know, a year before Public Enemy, yes, groups like UTFO, they're using break beats.
She needs a guy like me with a high IQ. And she takes my rap because my rap's the best. The educated rapper MD will never fess.
So this is one of the first times in which you're hearing an authentic breakbeat. Billy Squire's Big Beat, rock song by Billy Squire, is like, that's the drum background. So suddenly you're seeing it transform from house band to drum machine to, now we use the record collection inside of, you know. So as a result, and I'll get to pre-Public Enemy, as forward as hip-hop was more, again, more big beat sounding New York stuff.
Fighting routines or saying something kind of weak. My words are comprehended every time I speak. I have spoken, though I'm not joking. Please don't sleep, I hope you are awake.
Big drums, little stabbies there. Same with, or even with Rakim, like his brother played with Larry Smith from Run DMC and... Very musical sounding. So again, another example of
standing by the speaker. Suddenly I had this fever, wasn't me either. Some of madness, cause I just can't stand around. So
what happens is when Public Enemy first comes out, they sound rather like everyone else. They sound kind of primitive. Like, this is an example of their big beat. When I say big beat, it's a sound. It's the sound that a radio can withstand when you're walking down the block.
Mm-hmm.
Pre
with the boombox on your shoulder.
Right. The way that everyone has in-ear pods inside their, you know, in their headphones.
Yeah.
40 years ago, we literally just walked down the block with our big-ass radios.
And it's big drums, big loud drums.
Yes. Like, this makes you menacing as hell. If you want a reference, look at Bill Nunn and Do the Right Thing as Radio Raheem.
Yeah, just thinking. Yeah,
right. So that kind of big beat sounding spare drums. That's very typical for Public Enemy sound. And then...
On Yo Bum Rush.
Right. And then the B-side that changed everything. And the reason why I had to go through that elaborate pre-introduction is Rebel Without a Pause was, for, in my opinion, for the recording industry, and I mean hip-hop, I'm talking about the recording industry, how we treat samples. The same way that I would say Orson Welles' War of the Worlds was.
Yeah.
When that came on radio back in the 30s,
people were selling their stuff and like running for the hills.
Right. Everyone thought a real war was breaking out, and they were staring at the radios like, oh, the world's over. It says that. And they didn't know that it was a drama.
They didn't know it was real. Yeah.
Right. And so the first time this song gets played on the air is at 1 a.m. in Philadelphia, because Public Enemy just performed.
Shout out to Philadelphia, all the Philly folks.
Yes. Shout out
to my dad.
Great. Yeah. So what happens is Chuck D, after the show, comes to Street Beat with Lady B in Philadelphia and says, yeah, we got a new B-side. Because what happened was they heard Rakim. And Rakim is basically the BC-AD dividing line for modern hip-hop. Right, old school.
Yeah.
Like, before Rakim, it was like your dad rhyming. Rakim.
Nothing wrong with dads rhyming, for the record.
Well, now,
some dads on the stage.
But Rakim in 30 years will lead to where Kendrick Lamar is right now.
Exactly.
So imagine our Kendrick Lamar, like, this he's using iambic pentameter and all this intricate wordplay. And Public Enemy felt old. And so they had to beg Def Jam, like, let us do a non-album B-side so that we can at least sound like we're current.
Wow.
They were really, like, Rakim came out and just made any rapper that came before him irrelevant. Mm. And so he plays this record, and you just don't know. Like, I get goosebumps hearing it now. It's Rebel Without a Pause. And when this came out in 1987.
Yes, the rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme.
Literally, we didn't know what to do with the song. Like, it was just, it made everything that everything that music is supposed to be, scaring your parents, scaring the authorities, made you more confident when you walk down the block. Like, my nerd ass suddenly had, like, swag. Like. And as a result, everyone followed suit. So suddenly, that squeal in the background, which my father always thought was a tea kettle, this squeal... They, of course, filtered it. That, to us, was like a guitar solo. Like, hip-hop really didn't have something that channeled in, like, teen angst.
Mm.
Like, or the misunderstood teen. Like, this makes me feel more empowered. So, all of a sudden, the entire world of hip-hop followed suit. Groups like the Skinny Boys... Suddenly, you have to have an annoying loop in the background. That's an example of Skinny Boys, Get Pep. Dismasters, Small Time Hustler. So suddenly, every group needed an annoying noise to get your attention. And...
you're saying the 30-year-olds in our office who said, I can't listen to more than 15 minutes of this, they're latching onto something.
Right. But the thing was, it was such a monumental moment. You're not even thinking that they can even match it, or they can't even match it or come close to it. So in my mind, I'm just like, it's one and done. Like, Run DMC has one Rock Box or one Peter Piper. You're not expecting an entire album with something even pushing it further. So when Bring the Noise comes out and 3 months later, they go even more extreme.
Yo, Chuck, these dirty drippers are still front on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always do this. Yeah, boy.
Bass, how low can you go? Death Row.
Night of Living Bass Hit, same thing. Chaos everywhere.
Huge.
So Chuck D has a theory, and I actually subscribe to this theory, that hip-hop in five-year increments follows the drug of the moment.
Mm.
So the reason why the disco-fied sounds of the first period with the house band is the sound of blow, recreational cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
The big beat sound of that drum machine period. That's the 40-ounce period. So Chuck D said that because crack was tearing us apart. Mm. They wanted to be music's worst nightmare. And so what winds up happening is all those boring records in my dad's record collection are suddenly come to life.
Yeah.
And it becomes just a bouillabaisse, a goulash, like, let's add this and that and this, that, and just make chaos. And so as a result, N.W.A., Dr. Dre will take note from Public Enemy, and suddenly his music sounds more menacing. Here's a better example with the D.O.C., Dr. Dre and the D.O.C.
That much greater, straight up on the fader, bump the bass at the pace, most like Mother Doc, and this is it, because when it's hype, then I feel that it's the
Ice Cube does the same thing with Public Enemy's Production Squad.
Sure.
Make the whole lady say, oh my God, right, it's the Nitsy Alarm.
The Beastie Boys with their second album, same thing, rapid sampling all over the place. My last example is with Public Enemy, 2 years later, they will hit a ceiling with it. And the ceiling is, of course, clearance samples. No one's thinking about clearing
right.
these samples. So the Wild Wild West period of Public Enemy's kind of Yulee's Gold discovery thing is really just a short period between 87 and 91. And then once lawyers get involved, which is why like De La Soul took 30 years to clear all those samples.
Yeah. Which we talked about on a recent episode.
Yeah.
We were going to bring up the word chaos. There's so much going on, not just in their music, but in society at that time. I mean, like, you got to remember that this is before we had, you know, five, you know, news networks going 24 hours a day. You know, Chuck D famously said, we consider Public Enemy sort of like black people CNN.
The black CNN.
We're going to let you know what's going on. So there's like a Jesse Jackson sample here. We're going to get into samples in just a little bit. There's like, you know, a movie sample from over here.
Yeah.
And of course, they've got like all these like musical samples. Real quick, P.E. in general, and Chuck D in particular, said that this album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, was their attempt to make hip-hop's What's Going On. Do you think they succeeded? And if so, in what way?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, and I'm going to be very careful for how I word this. Because even now, there's sort of talk on the internets concerning the reception of Cowboy Carter, which is basically, you know, there's some sort of conversation going on as to whether or not how important is the Academy approval for your art? Like, is it beauty and is it art on its own, or do you need the cosign? Mm. And of course, there's, you know, some there's a lot of Hotepian sort of thing, like, well, we don't need a, you know, white approval to say that this is art. But, you know, I will say that for Public Enemy, that was the first album in which, as a critic junkie, a person that would read religiously the Village Voice record reviews, Robert Christgau, Greg Tate, to for the first time see hip-hop salivated over almost in a way that, like, they were talking about Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys or the White Album by the Beatles. Like, this is real art. And yes, it's art regardless. However, that album was such a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Like, it literally changed music. I mean, even a group like TLC, who sold gazillion units, their sound is pretty much based on Public Enemy.
That's
like,
great.
All the work that Dallas Austin did.
Yo, mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Like, this is their first single.
So, I mean, you just strummed all my Atlanta heartstrings just now.
Yeah.
I mean, like, seriously, we heard the similarities between TLC and that Bomb Squad production, for sure.
Yeah, and basically, that's also, this will also explain why people praise The Chronic.
Mm-hmm.
Because with The Chronic, Dr. Dre, in one fell swoop, will just clear the whole table of the chaos. He'll slow the music down, because then the drug of the moment wasn't crack. It was weed. Right.
Yeah.
So thus he slowed it down.
Damn you, Dre.
And
we had more crack stories to tell.
And the whole California, you know. Yeah.
It was like, more laid back. It was honestly going from like John Coltrane to like Miles Kind of Blue, which is like a West Coast jazz album.
A very laid back.
And literally
breezy.
The tempos are slowing down too.
But right? Still gangster. Yeah. Yes.
But still gangster. Hey, before we go any further, we do have to take a break.
Yes.
But after the break, we will have more Questlove, more Public Enemy. We'll have stems. We will have fun. We will have games. To play. Woo! People like games. We will have more nerddom and we will have Cold Lamp of a Flavor. Stick around. We will be right back. Shout out to US Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song. And for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their Summer Splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in-store or online at Whole Foods Market today.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well.
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
All right, we are back, and Luxury, you have some stems and some information for us.
I do, but I've got so many questions for Quest. So,
yes.
But we're going to jump around a bit. First, the Bomb Squad, we've been talking about them, just to put some names behind, you know, the moniker of the group. The Bomb Squad is the production team behind Public Enemy. So it's Chuck D, mm-hmm. also known as Carlton Douglas Ridenour, Hank Shockley, who's born James Boxley III, by the way. But Hank Shockley might have been a good name for the Bomb Squad. His brother, by the way, Keith Shockley, is the fourth member. But in this particular case for this song, Eric Vietnam Sadler. So the three of them together are the production crew mm-hmm. behind this track. And their technique, and I'm going to kind of go back and forth a little bit because I had a question. You were walking us through wonderfully the history of kind of, among other things, how beats are coming into use in hip hop,
yes.
right? We go from the backing band from Sugar Hill Gang performing a Sheik song,
mm-hmm.
and then that being recorded, and then it being one of the first, you know, replay lawsuits when Nile Rodgers walks in a club and go, "Hey, wait a second, that's our
my song. Right?
Wait a second, no, that's not us."
Fun fact,
yeah,
bass player,
yeah,
Sylvia Robinson.
No, she yes. plays bass.
She's playing what? Guitar on Love Is Strange.
That's amazing, Sylvia Robinson.
Love is strange. Like, she okay. was a musician too. People don't know
that's
that.
Amazing,
in addition
yeah.
to being a CEO and a yeah. singer.
And yeah. she had like a single in the 60s, Somebody and Sylvia.
Mickey and Sylvia.
Mickey and
Love
Sylvia,
is Strange
yeah.
and also Pillow Talk in the 70s.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we go from live bass, live band basically making the entire track.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have drum machines and samples are both kind of separate things.
Yes.
But you were sort of walking us through, especially with Marley Marl, is this moment where you can take the entire sample and take a little piece of it and you can start blending it with drum machines and start to have a track that doesn't just have one beat happening.
Exactly.
It's got a bunch of little bits and pieces. I have a feeling that's what we're going to be walking through a bit.
Because
when I opened up the track you sent me, when I opened up the stems, I was like, there are like 10 different drum events taking place in this.
Yes.
Yeah.
So essentially what, so there was a brief period in which I taught at NYU, and now the current dean there, Nick Cinsano, was the lead engineer for this album.
Oh, okay.
And what he revealed to me was just the most mind-blowing.
That's what we got to hear. Oh, my God.
Can't wait. The first thing I did was I commissioned and asking you shall receive. I asked for the entire Public Enemy canon, or at least Fear of a Black Planet and Nation of Millions as stems just to...
Go through the mother load. Wow.
Yeah, just to look at what they did. And you've never seen a more meticulous... tracking, like the track sheets alone for Night of the Living Bassheads, which is a song that, to answer your question at the top of the show when you asked why this song,
yeah,
this was the second most chaotic song. Night of the Living Bassheads is way too chaotic for us to really grasp how all these small parts make a whole.
Right.
In basketball terms, you know, like if you're just looking at a Kobe or a Jordan, like. You see, like, or singing, like one Michael and his four brothers. Whereas it's better to look at a team where everyone's adding these small elements together to make a big story. And this is one of the more unassuming songs because, but yet it's everything that Public Enemy is about. Random samples out of nowhere that sound weird on their own, but once put together. Makes total sense. And so Nick Cinsano, the first thing he reveals to me is that they did this album is not mixed or engineered, which I never heard of that.
It is the way they made it.
The process how most people make records is you write a song, you might demo that song. Everyone learns the song. Everyone goes in the studio. And then you record that song. And once that song is on tape, you take a break. You live with it. And then you come back to EQ and mix how you want it to sound. I don't know if it's because they wanted to save time or not. But what they actually did was they pre-produced the album. The only other person I know that does work like this was Barry White. And Ray Parker Jr. says that Barry White didn't want to do any overdubbing because he wanted to be in and out the studio so he could pocket all the money. Again, so...
Come on, Barry.
No, but Ray Parker Jr. would say, like, there would be four guitar players on the same song because instead of getting one guitar player to take all day doing four parts, he was just like, no. All four of you play at the same time. We're going to do this all in one fell swoop. Everyone gets there an hour early. The engineer pre-mixes, so it's to Barry's liking. And when they record it, that's how
it's going to... There's no overdubbing later. There's
no
mixing.
Overdubbing, no mixing.
One and done.
This was done the same way. So if you... I should have brought the Night of the Living Bassheads tracking sheet. Eric Sadler's notes, literally, it's a 200... an almost 83 bar account for what's going to happen. So like in bar 76, he writes down David Bowie sample, left side, the Temptation sample in the bridge, like literally each bar is accounted.
He's got to be a Virgo because I identify with that deeply.
It's anal retentiveness to the next level.
I respect that.
Yeah.
That makes sense though, because how else are they going to keep track of it? But to your point, which I had no idea, you have to remember also at this time, in order to mix a song, right, or in order to bounce it to tape, you got 24 faders.
Yes.
So you got five guys with like 3 to 4 faders each. They have to know what to do because like on a dropout, they all have to know, okay, here's the bar where we all ride the faders, you know, or mute or whatever it is. That has to be known. It can't be like on the fly. So it makes sense that he's writing all this down.
And so the way that I'm to believe the story is told, each member of the Bomb Squad, Hank, Keith, Eric, occasionally Flavor Flav. Mm-hmm. Chuck wasn't part of this process. They would actually have jam sessions. So each guy had their own drum machine, right. their own turntable, and they would load in all their sounds. So
that,
song yeah. like Don't Believe the Hype is literally them. Matter of fact, Rebel Without a Pause is not programmed. It's played. This is actually the operation of a lot. Like the amount
Are
of
you
stuff-
saying that like there's no computer that's like quantize okay, this yeah, thing. It's literally close. Being done live.
This is so this practice is so normal and it's mind blowing. Even not to fall off subject, Jimmy Jam just revealed to me they never use Simpty. He was like, Simpty's what keeps everything in line.
Mm-hmm.
He was just like, well, I was a DJ back in the day, so it when was. We would do a remix, he would literally take the reels and just blend the reels as if he was a DJ. So all those Janet Jackson Cool Summer mixes. Is just them playing stuff.
Internal clock.
Yeah, without.
Jam's heartbeat.
So
that is,
thus.
This is insane.
So thus, this Public Enemy album maybe has an appeal because, in the way that I'd salivate over the work of J Dilla, like how like it's offbeat and jarring, maybe there's a subconscious version of that with this record in which it's so sloppily crafted together that it sounds human.
It's crazy that you can take all these tiny little parts. There's nothing telling you, oh, the next beat is here, the next beat is here, and create something cohesive. Can you play us one of your stems?
Yeah, let's start getting into these stems here. Yeah. I mean, we're going to listen.
Play us one.
There are no fewer than, I'm going to count, about 8 different drum tracks, but half of them, more than half of them, are just a single hi-hat or a single snare. There's three different kick drums happening, and the intricacy with which they all come in and out is perfection. And the fact that it's done the way you've described it is sort of mind-blowing. But let's get into it. So here are the first 3 stems, and these are all kick drums.
Yes.
And I'll play them isolated and then in the mix together. This is kick number 1. And by the way, importantly, to my point earlier, I was talking about how there are 808s on this record. That sounds like an 808. And from what I've understood, maybe you know more than me about this, so please enlighten us. Mm-hmm. I understand the 808s on this record were all sampled from 808s on records as
Other
opposed
records.
To the 808 drum machine.
Yeah.
And the only bass content in this song, or majority of it, is coming from what I just played for you. There's not a bass line per se. There are samples that have technically some bass content because it's the lower end of the EQ. But most of the bass, that's the bass line of the song as well as the kick drum. And it interacts with these other 2 kicks. This is one of them, which is obviously just a chopped kick drum. You may know the
I'm
source
I'm trying
of that.
To figure yeah, out yeah. what sample it comes from. I can actually...
If anyone knows, it's you.
I know it, but I can't name it now.
Here's a second kick drum that's also sounding like a sample.
One, two, three, four. One, two.
And now I'll play them together, and then I'll start adding in some of the other component parts, which are the 2 snares and hi-hat that are also sampled individually. That's all 3 kicks.
3, 4,
and I'll start to bring in some snares.
2, 3, 4.
And some hi-hats. And now we got some toms coming in. So that drum beat, what you just heard, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different things.
Yes.
And we're not even done. I'm going to play you the breakbeat isolated, one of the 2 breakbeats isolated. Wes, what is
Trouble
that?
Funk.
That's Trouble Funk.
Yeah.
Go, go.
Let's,
DC
I think
go,
it's,
go band.
I think it's a Let's Get Small. Yeah. So, to give you context.
There it is. That's a beautiful, big, juicy break. You got to use that.
These are probably the hardest drums of the first era of hip-hop. Like, even though Trouble Funk is a go-go band, there's kind of a church and state, oil and water, but, you know, they're all one. However, sonically, from a sonic perspective, yeah, I'll say that Trouble Funk as a band sonically is probably the best engineered group of musicians.
Not like, not Synthetic Substitution.
Well, but that's not that's. Well, I mean, that's you know, that's Bernard Purdy, right?
Huh?
That's Bernard Purdy, yes, drumming exactly, on yeah. Synthetic Substitution.
Melvin Bliss Jr. artist, but yes,
yeah. Purdy's the but I'm just yeah. saying that that's a record that was recorded in 69, yeah. 70. So I don't count that as I count that as the part of the ingredients. But yeah. I'm talking about from a band after hip hop is invented. Mm-hmm. Those are really exceptional.
Right.
Hard. Like, hard is a compliment in the hip-hop
oh,
world.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's hard.
Well, it's also hard. Like, it's also challenging because what we're hearing together, like, on its own, that has some swing to it, but not everything has the same swing. And somehow, you're about to hear me play them all together. The way yeah. they come together, that's the magic here. But we have one
There's
more breakbeat.
There's another drum. Yeah, I was going to say.
There's one more breakbeat. We've already heard it today because he played it for us.
Right.
And it's you've all heard it a bajillion times. It's from the It Takes Two to Make a Thing Go Right. It's the same song, but it's the drum break.
Oh, think Lynn Collins.
Lynn yeah. Collins, JB's. We've heard a lot of JB's already today. We're not done. And notice how they do it. They started there. One, two, three, and then back to the one. One. Two. So they're already kind of boom, two, three, yeah. one, one, right?
And this also, I believe, confirms my theory. Even though we credit Clyde Stubblefield and Funky Drummer, the drum break Funky Drummer by James Brown is often, you know, applauded as, you know, the greatest breakbeat of all time. Right. And it is. However, you know, if you really look under the surface, for those who don't know, Funky Drummer is
you got 1, 2, 3, 4, get it.
The only flop in James Brown's career is like his most popular sample
of all time.
Yeah. Well, for the streak between 65 yes.
and that's
and
on no fewer yeah. than two or three songs on this record altogether, oh, but
well,
not this
Funky,
song.
Funky yeah. Drummer is literally the manna from heaven that will provide
the gift that
you
keeps
know.
Giving.
Yeah. yeah.
You about, but you were about to say about Clyde. I want you to.
Yeah, but the thing is that Clyde Stubblefield, James Brown's one of his many drummers, is given credit, and yes, it's a work of art, but I always considered Funky Drummer to be kind of like boutique shopping, bespoke. In other words, it's his other drummer, John Jabbo Starks, is, in my opinion, kind of really the meat and potatoes of the James Brown drummers, and is actually, that break is used more than Funky Drummer. Basically, Clyde gets the glory of being James Brown's, you know, number right. one drummer. But really, you could do more with John Jabbo Starks' snares and stuff, which is why it gets used more than like the sound of New Jack Swing. Boot dat 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 boot dat 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 dat. Like think of like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme, like Motown Philly, like all the New Jack, all the stuff on Michael Jackson's Dangerous record. Like the sound
can you,
of.
Can you give us an example? Because I don't know that I know. That's Jabbo.
All right, let me take the drums off. So the reason is all right, so Jabbo's strength is actually his kick. When James Brown is explaining the theory of the one, he's basically saying that there's more emphasis on the, you know, it's one, two, three. But James Brown says, one, two, three, four. Like, we all have to be in agreement. So I will say that Jabbo's kick foot is gargantuanly strong. So all of his... So thus, it gives you a better option. Whereas Clyde Stubblefield's drumming. Clyde's drumming on What Do I Have to Do to Prove My Love to You is a wonder to hear because his left hand, listen to the work that his left hand does.
What do I have to do?
A lot of snare ghost
notes.
A
lot of grace notes. Right, which is cool, but it determines too much. And with Jabbo, you can, you have more options to get the James Brown texture so that you can determine how the rhythm should go. Whereas with Clyde, you have to adjust to his his world. So truth be told, John Jabbo Starks is probably not only the go-to choice of James Brown's drummers to use for stuff like this, but also just in period of like the whole sampling culture. Like John Jabbo never gets...
Doesn't get enough love?
Yeah, because he's too normal. Like it's like Converse. Like and Air Force Ones will never die no matter what. You know what I mean? You're always going to have the white Air Force Ones and the canvas Converse from back in the 40s.
Yeah.
That's what John Jabbo Starks is. Meanwhile, the Jordan 6 limited edition, that's Clyde Stubblefield. Like, it's a shinier story.
No, it's true. Peter Bogdanovich
I should have just said that at the top instead of taking 25 minutes.
That totally worked. I was saying that Peter Bogdanovich is wearing the same shoes that I used to wear in high school in Last Picture Show. And it's just because everybody can wear those Converse. It doesn't, you know.
It will never go away.
Yeah.
In the interest, let's hear all of that put together so that we have the drum track.
We've just set up how those beats, those eight different sources, I think, are forming this combined single beat, which has complexity and yet together it works. So I'm going to play just those two samples together first, and then I'll bring back that the three kicks and two snares situation that we had. These are both breakbeats together. And now I'll bring in everything, all the beats. That's eight different sample sources in 1988.
The use of the
smallest. Now, mind you, it's not blended and, you know.
Right, exactly.
But the idea is there.
Right, the idea is there.
It wouldn't be Public Enemy if there wasn't rap. It wouldn't be anybody rapping on this one if it wasn't Flavor Flav.
I'm lamping, I'm lamping, I'm cold lamping. I got Louis, boy, I'm not tramping. I just came from the crib, you know. I'm wanna go, throw your tank in the metro.
Let's talk a little bit about Flav. You know, coming up, like, I feel like Chuck D was like the draw in for Public Enemy, but Flavor Flav was like, even my dad who liked Public Enemy, he used to talk about how he, in his mind, Flavor was like the court jester. You know, he was like the guy, like, if I think someone online said, if Chuck D was all by himself, it would almost be way too serious.
It wouldn't work.
You needed somebody like Flavor Flav to show up with the clock.
Comic relief.
And be like, yeah, boy. Like, it's almost like the first seasons of The Simpsons. Like, you needed Bartman, you know, to get you to seasons 4 and 5 when they're like, oh, Homer's actually the star of the show. You know what I mean? Like, in that sense, the show doesn't exist without Flavor.
I'm going to word this extremely carefully, especially in light of Billy D. Williams' recent quotes.
Oh, no.
Right. No. No, but the thing is that I think throughout history, especially at that point in 1980, for black people really to gain mainstream America's trust, humor was a weapon of choice.
It's stealth.
There's an interesting, and the reason why I didn't kind of want to be careful how I word this, there's a Black America's first millionaire actor, Step and Fetch It. Right. Now look at your face.
Right.
We went 30-something episodes of this show
without mentioning Minstrel C.
Thank you for crossing the Rubicon.
No. But here's the thing, though. I found out something in the last 5 years that it never occurred to me.
Uh-oh.
Now, of course, Step and Fetch It and kind of his offspring, or at least the next 10 years of, you know, Amos and Andrew, actors that had to wear
Antoine
black
Moreland.
Faces.
Yeah, right. We get it.
What I didn't know was that it's one thing when you think that if someone has to use a kind of court jester, clownish thing.
Yeah.
You kind of think that that's them.
Mm-hmm.
And I later found out that Step and Fetch It discovered early, if I keep white people laughing in the 30s and 40s, I might not get lynched.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, sure.
So it's a protective measure. Yeah. And once, and that's a weird thing because it's humor is, has been used much to our chagrin. There's a serious sect of folk who, you know, rightfully so, says this is very degrading, very, you know.
Sure. That I mean, we're literally talking about Public Enemy that had a song called Burn Hollywood Burn.
Exactly.
Which had the incendiary video with all these images that I, as a kid, I was like, wait, Bugs Bunny was racist? He used to do blackface and sing Live in Dixie? Like, it was very
It was
jarring.
The norm.
But
So yeah, the reason why I'm bringing this up is that the kind of sort of we come in peace, hands up, don't shoot.
Yeah.
Level of acrobats that most black artists have to go through in order to gain acceptance. The reason why James Brown required his band to always wear suits. Why do we have to wear suits even off stage? Well, you know, in case we get pulled over, you'll look respectable politics. That whole, you know, yep. And there's also a downside to this whole respectable politics thing.
Of course.
Which is why a group like Sly and the Family Stone, one of the first original Zero Fucks Given groups, like, we're going to come dressed in our street clothes.
Yeah.
You can't go on stage without a suit. Are you crazy? You know, that's what it was.
Never book Sullivan.
Exactly. So Chuck knew instantly that Public Enemy needed a comedic factor to sort of take away from the seriousness of the group, or else they were going to scare everybody. And here's the thing, though. It worked. Because when I first got the Public Enemy record in 1987, their first album, they were, they're all right. They're cool. However, when I got to Flav's solo song, Too Much Posse, I was 14 years old, and suddenly, mm-hmm. like, I was like, yo, who's this guy talking all this shit?
All right, party people, you bust the groove. It's guaranteed to shake your butt and make you move. I got a little something fly that's gonna keep you high. It's not a drug from under the rug.
So on each song, this guy, like, I would listen to Public Enemy's album just to hear the guy talk shit. Mm-hmm. Even on diss records, like, when you hear a diss record, the lyrics are okay, but it's always the last part that you want to hear where they're just talking like, yeah, motherfucker, now the next time you talk shit, it's
Tupac. Never. Tupac, like, the last 12 minutes of Hit 'Em Up is just him airing some stuff out.
Dude, I would actually.
It's almost like, man, forget all this rapping. I don't like you.
Dude, I would respect Tupac's Hit 'Em Up.
Yes.
If his music tracking was better. This sounds to me like...
Hot takes. Here we go.
No, this all sounds right. like... Look, I've already gone on the internet and spoke. But Hit 'Em Up, to me, is disqualified, not because of the overly...
Vitriol?
Yeah, the misogynist. Like, forget all that. It's like, dude, you're rhyming over, like, smooth jazz dinner music.
Dennis Edwards.
Luther Vandross could sing over this.
Okay. Wait. Hold on.
So wait, you.
We are talking. Hold on. This is Dennis Edwards.
Wait,
right? Am I right?
Yes.
This is Dennis
Don't look
Edwards
any further.
Wait, I'm curious.
Don't look any further.
I'm curious because yes. I know. How many years younger are you to me?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how old you are. I'm not even.
Well,
lying.
Let's not reveal that now.
Okay. Yeah.
But I assume that you might be
a couple of years,
to 5 to 6 years younger than me.
We'll see.
Right. No, but this is always a difference because people who are born in the latter part of the decade that I was born
uh-huh.
in. All right, I was born in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Newsflash.
All right. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, like their relationship with Tupac is different than my relationship.
Yes.
And so thus, when this came out, I was just like, you know, they were like, yo, this is hard as shit, man. Yo, he's killing it. And I was just like, dog, he smooth jazzed up Dennis Edwards. Like, it doesn't count.
Don't look any further. Don't you look no further. Damn, my damn. The champagne on fire. Well, don't look any further. Someone to count on.
But you know what's crazy is, and I remember exactly where I was sitting. I was sitting outside a Turtles record store in the heart of Southwest
Ooh,
Atlanta.
Turtles.
I was sitting out there in my car. And I was listening to this, and I was like, ooh, this is going to end bad. Like, because nobody had released it. I mean, like, No Vaseline by Ice Cube is rough, but even this sounded way more personal. And the fact that he didn't in my brain, he didn't want to clear the Dennis Edwards sample, so he had like the Death Row All-Star Band like replay the music,
and
that's why it sounds like
that. To me, hurts my feelings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like to me,
it'd be a better song if he had sampled just the original.
You mean if there wasn't an interpolation? Yes, I did it. I got one in there. I got one in.
He gets paid when he says that word. You guys.
Thank you very much.
My thing is, if you're going to annihilate me on a diss record, like at least have the respect.
To take somebody to
like, if you're gonna kill me, I want you to take me out like Cleo at the end of Set It Off, like that sort of thing. Like I can't get with Hit 'Em Up because the music to me is just because
that's fair. You know, I actually think that you know we should do this show is called One Song, and obviously we deviate from just talking about one song, but I do think we should do like a special format breaker one-off called a One Beef and just break down the history of beef tracks in hip-hop. It probably had to be a two-parter because there's some great ones going from, you know, Roxanne's Revenge all the way up into the current kerfuffle. But I just got to point out that while we're talking about Hit 'Em Up and some of these other beef songs, this is technically a beef track because you start off Cold Lampin' with Flavor.
Oh.
You start off with the Mr. Magic. And we talked a little bit about this before you showed up here. I actually have the clip. It starts off with, you know, No More Music for Suckers. Let's hear just a little bit of the song that was sampled from this.
Okay, so the backstory is Mr. Magic's not a fan of Public Enemy.
He's not a... Mr. Magic, it turns out, was not an early fan of Public Enemy.
Yeah.
Let's check it out.
Which we'll be back with 30 minutes of nonstop rap attacking. I guarantee you, No More Music by the Suckers. We'll be back after this.
Like, how are you going to be playing somebody's song
off the turntable
and basically saying, yeah, these guys suck?
Mr. Magic, but I mean, Mr. Magic basically, if you want to know the legacy of Mr. Magic was the...
We talked a little bit about him.
Yeah, he was like the guy you had to impress in radio.
Yeah.
And what winds up happening is, I mean, look at the Boogie Down Productions situation. Boogie Down Productions approaches Mr. Magic and says, hey, here's our tape. Will you play it on your radio show? He plays it, and he disses them. And he dissed them so hard that he's just like, yo, this is weak, and he throws the tape and leaves. Marley Marl, who's also at that session, is realizing now it's one of me and seven of these guys, I better get out of here too. So without thinking, Marley Marl just vacates the premises, but he leaves behind his drum his drum reels. And so when we talked about that snare at the top of the bridge, that snare on MC Shan's The Bridge, people, basically BDP was like, oh yeah, we whack? Well, we got your drum sounds.
Woo.
So thus, weird enough, and I went back to listen to that song.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard the song that Mr. Magic heard?
Public Enemy number one?
No, I'm talking about Boogie Down Productions.
Oh.
I'm just saying the history of
you're talking about The Bridge Is Over now.
Right, but literally the song that Boogie Down Productions did was almost akin to... It was almost neck and neck with the theme of the Fresh Prince of Bel Air. And do your homework, and then we got to win. You know, and
like, where is the KRS-One in this?
It's right, and so thus, kind of, Mr. Magic was right. He could have did it in a more nuanced, polite way of saying, "You guys got to try better." So what winds up happening is Marley Marl's drum sound patch basically just gets passed around the entire hip-hop nation, and thus that drum, his drum patches will wind up feeding.
And he's done all the work of isolating the snare, the kick,
yeah, he,
all
he these did the work. Things. He did the work for you, so a lot of those songs come from that. But yes, also, Mr. Magic wasn't a fan of Rebel Without a Pause either. He thought that Chuck D... So I think the reason why Chuck D got in his head about... Oh, this is my fault. Like, he thinks I'm old. And Chuck D was old. He was 29
by rapper standards, yeah.
Yeah, he was already over the hill.
Yeah.
And so the reason why he felt the pressure to make this record was because he felt that Mr. Magic thought he was whack.
Wow.
And he didn't really want to do this. Rick Rubin had to beg him, please take this record deal. You have a great voice. Ah, man, I'm too old for this. And so the provoking of Mr. Magic and the non-approval or the unapproving stance of Mr. Magic is what will prompt some of the greatest music to fall out of the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have something to prove.
I think we need to ask real quickly, what do you think is the legacy of Cole Lampin with Flavor?
You know, there are 16 songs on this record. So to me, it's like, okay, gross example. If someone right now ripped 5 of your toenails off completely.
Okay. I love where this is going.
Right. The way that your audience has grown right now. I meant, will it kill you? It's painful as hell, but will it kill you? Not really. I'm just saying that Cole Lampin with Flavor is an important part of this Godzilla monster known as It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Now, is it an important organ like the heart or the brain or, you know, the knees? That remains to be seen. I mean, in terms of if you prioritize the important songs of it, yes, it's a Flavor Flav solo song. But for me, it was sort of like almost like a needed comic relief on it's the fourth song on this record of which they already kind of just burnt down the entire village.
Yeah.
Black radio, bourgeois black people,
yeah.
Crack dealers. Like in the first four songs, they just light the entire, the education system. So it's like, and now a commercial break. And then Flav comes along and then the rest of the album continues. So in the body of Nation of Millions, I'll say that maybe Cole Lampin with Flavor might be your wrist. Still need it.
Yeah.
Still need it, but it's just a small piece to a bigger puzzle.
Absolutely. And by the way, even though we're only four songs deep into the album, probably 200 samples used by that point. Luxury, I'm going to invite you to say what you think the legacy of this song and that Bomb Squad sound is.
I mean, I don't have much to add because that was perfectly put. I will say one thing that we didn't get a chance to talk about too much that I would love to hear your thoughts on is we talked a little bit about the abrasiveness of sound and the absence of bass. But another thing, I mean, we've got a Slayer sample on this record, right? We have at a certain point Public Enemies on tour with Gang of Four.
Yeah.
They do a tour with Sisters of Mercy, by the way, one of my favorite goth bands who I see.
Pro Gang of Four.
And then, of course, there's the famous Anthrax collab, which is essentially a cover version.
Right.
But it's Anthrax and Public Enemy doing Bring the Noise.
How low can you go? Death row. What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one.
So there's a lot of, I would say, sonically as well as aggression and lyrically, there is some post-punk and punk and metal and rock in this band.
P.E.'s slowly discovering that, like, mosh culture is how these acts that they're opening for respond to them. You know, if it were 15 years early and you were James Brown, you know, some funky stuff to make you want to move and groove your head like that is the order of the day. But because Public Enemy is sort of coming in a weird raps version of Bad Brains, if you will.
Totally.
If you look at the 82 CBGB's Bad Brains performance, like that level of adrenaline, that's what Public Enemy is slowly discovering that they need to come across in order to survive on the road as a road band.
I'm so glad you said that, by the way, because I just found it in researching this episode that the Slayer sample was originally a Bad Brain sample. Did you know that? It was originally a Reignition, the track on Eye Against Eye.
Really?
Yeah. I just found that out. Yeah. So Bad Brains is absolutely in the mix.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did you just tell him something he doesn't know? This is news.
We'll cut that.
I just saw your face. You did not know that.
Hey, man.
Our job is complete.
Mind blown.
Good night, everybody.
Woo! I will sleep tonight.
So the last thing we're going to do is we're going to play a game.
Mm-hmm.
It's called 5 degrees of, everyone say it with me, interpolation. 5 degrees of interpolation. Here's how it works.
Okay.
Our producer, Matt, that gentleman over there, he's written down two names, and they are sealed in an envelope. No one has seen what's inside of these envelopes. What you have to do is connect the two artists named in the envelope via five steps or less. So okay. We're going to get two names. It's like 5 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but with interpolation. So you can connect them through songs, writing credits, samples, interpolations, or even interpolations, whatever it takes to connect these names. So I'm going to have this revealed to me. I'll be the only one with the knowledge.
Okay.
5 degrees between the following two names. 60 seconds on the clock. And away we go. Chuck D to Mel B, a.k.a. Scary Spice. 60 seconds.
Okay, so I believe that connection-wise... okay, so Chuck D sampled Bobby Bird's Hot Pants, I'm Coming, which has John Jabro Starks on a Caught, Can I Get a Witness, a.k.a. the Big Daddy Kane Raw break.
You're eating up time.
And I believe that, oh. And I believe one. Wannabe is the drum track to that.
What? Woo! We did it in two?
He got there in two.
He did it in two?
He what? Got there.
That's Are you saying Wannabe from Spice Girls?
Yeah, they both used Hot Pants, I'm Coming. As
he got there technically in one.
Okay.
We gave him five. He got there in one.
Okay.
Sorry.
I think you just ultimately proved your Questloveness.
Did I run out my minute?
I think you solved it in 12 seconds. But I think we have so much wonderful stuff that we discussed here. And there's so much stuff that we would love to, like, I can't tell you how much we wanted to discuss. But sincerely, we can't think. We'll have you back on the show. And when you
Thank
come
you so
back
much,
on the
man.
Show,
yes.
I want you to...
What song?
Here's the thing. I'm not saying you have these stems, but if you want to borrow the D'Angelo stems.
Oh, my God. Something from Voodoo.
And so we could talk
Please.
About Voodoo.
Yeah.
Be kind of cool. Mm-hmm. You obviously don't have those things because that could get you in trouble. Yeah. If you
maybe
said that
maybe
you had
I found them. Maybe I found them.
Yeah, put it on him.
Maybe I found them.
Hey, it fell off a truck, right?
It fell off a truck.
I was told
With
to fall
bunch
off
of
the
cigarettes.
Truck.
Mm-hmm. All right, everyone. This has been so much fun. Questlove, my friend, thank you so much for being here. Everybody, make some noise for Questlove for coming through. That was incredible. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that. You can download Questlove's podcast, QLS, wherever you download your podcast. And that's the same for our show. I am Diallo Riddle.
I am Luxury.
You can find us, I'm at Diallo on Instagram. And
I'm at Luxury with two X's on all the social media sites.
Exactly. We've had a great time. Thank you for coming.
So much fun having you guys here. Thank you.
And this was one song.
Yay! This episode was produced by our producer, Matthew Nelson. Additional production support from Casey Simonson. Engineering from Marcus Hom.
The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, Eric Weil, and Leslie Guam.
I'm Issa Nakazawa. Join me on Stars and Stars with Issa, where I welcome today's stars to find out what their birth chart reveals about them.
I'm laughing because I'm like, these are two big topics in my life. It's crazy because I feel all those ways at once.
Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their Summer Splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in store or online at Whole Foods Market today.